Good evening and welcome to Front Page Boston. I'm Bill Forey of the Dorchester Reporter.
I'm Yahoo Miller with the Bay State Banner.
Thanks for joining us again in this edition. We every week look at the news and headlines of the Bay State Banner, the Dorchester Reporter, and other community media to see what's going on in Boston and the neighborhoods in particular that we cover and have been covering for decades. And thanks for joining us. Yahoo, this week the lead story in the Bay State Banner is about and it's an exclusive that the Banner had, well ahead of everyone else in the city, about the mayor intending to revamp the police review board. Can you tell us what that is?
Right. It's the co-op board. It's the Civilian Ombudsman Oversight Panel Board. It was created, I believe, in 2007. After years of calls from elected officials and community activists for civilian oversight of the police, going back to at least as far back as the Charles Stewart incident in 1989, in the aftermath of that, there was a report done by Attorney James St. Clair. And in his report, his recommendations on how to reform the police department, he recommended that the city establish a civilian oversight review board. Now, police unions have always been opposed to that. But again, in 2007, Mayor Tom Menino created this Civilian Ombudsman Oversight Panel Board.
Three-person board.
It's a three-person board, and they essentially, unlike most civilian review boards that you see in other cities, this board only has the power to review investigations that have already been conducted by the police department's internal affairs division. A lot of people feel like this process doesn't give a fair, impartial look at allegations of police misconduct.
So this board, as it existed, wouldn't get its own complaints brought to them. They would have to wait for the Boston police to do their own internal investigation, and then they would review their work.
Is that right? So you'll receive a finding from IAD if you file a complaint, and then you're supposed to be informed that you have 2 weeks to appeal to the co-op board. Mm-hmm. And if you appeal within that 2 weeks, then the co-op board will review the investigation that IAD conducted, and then they have the power to say that it was either fair or unfair, that it was like a sufficient investigation or insufficient investigation, and once they've done that, they can write a sternly worded letter to the commissioner, and ultimately it's the commissioner's decision whether to reopen the investigation or not. Mm-hmm. So what they don't have the power to do is they don't have the power to conduct their own investigation, to interview witnesses, to interview the officer who was, charged, with an incident of misconduct. It's a very limited scope. Yeah. And over the years, people have been dissatisfied with it. Walsh's, Mayor Walsh's response, I think, to a lot of the criticism is to increase the number of people on the Civilian Review Board from 3 to 5, and also to increase the number of randomly selected cases that the board reviews. Currently, they'll review 10% of all the cases that are randomly select 10% of all cases that go to IAD. And, do the same assessment. And he's going to increase that to 20%, but also increase the number of people on the board to from 3 to 5. And then in any cases of, alleging police misconduct particularly that involve incidents of violence or allegations of bias, mm-hmm. That the co-op board would also automatically review those cases as well. Still the same end of the process, where the commissioner would look at these cases and it would ultimately be up to the commissioner.
The news of this change to the co-op board is still filtering out, I think, into the community. Obviously, the Banner reported this, and it hit the newsstands yesterday. And it's just come out to other media today. So It's early, but what's the initial reaction been to people that you've talked to, Yawu?
So I spoke to a couple of attorneys, Carl Williams from the ACLU and Howard Friedman, who's a in private practice, and both of whom review a lot of these cases. They said that the bigger issues, you know, other than the co-op board review, are, you know, again, that there's no independent review. IAD takes its time going through these cases. You know, people will often wait a couple of years before they get a finding. And, so basically they were saying that they don't trust IAD to conduct the same, you know, to review these cases impartially. Now, I didn't go to to black elected officials or other people who've been pushing for a civilian review board as yet. I did do an on-the-street interview in our roving camera on page 6, where I asked people, you know, civilians on the street, you know, do you think that the police department should have an independent review board? And, you know, as you could sort of expect, everybody said yes. They don't trust the police to investigate themselves because, they feel that the police have a vested interest in protecting their own.
And so, obviously, this will be one issue in the upcoming and now ongoing mayoral campaign. It's also likely to come up as a major topic next week. The NAACP Boston chapter, along with Mamleo and other organizations, are hosting a very pointed forum on police and public safety in general, and Mayor Walsh's performance of managing and working with public safety unions in particular about hiring, diversity hires, body cameras, the whole litany of public safety issues, which are likely to become a major part of this campaign, especially with Councilor Jackson as the most prominent of his opponents.
It's certainly a wedge issue where black voters see things differently than white voters. I want to say it was about 15 years ago, or 10 or 15 years ago, the police department did a survey, and they asked, you know, black people in, say, you know, Area B3 in Mattapan, what do you think, to what extent do you think racial profiling is an issue? 70% said yes, whereas citywide, like, you know, 40% of respondents said yes. So there's a radically different view of the role of police, depending on where you live in Boston and, you know, frankly, the color of your skin.
No question. So. Well, and so just about this election, we should mention that there is some new information this week now. We've reported before that there were 3 people who made the ballot for mayor. There are now 4. The new name is from East Boston, Robert Cappucci, who is, we don't know much about Mr. Cappucci yet. We're still reporting, but is evidently a retired Boston police officer who lives in East Boston, has sought to run for mayor before, made the ballot, decided not to run. Evidently, this was in 2013, and now has made the ballot. It's not clear whether he'll go forward or not, but at the moment, he's on the ballot and he joins Tito Jackson, the incumbent Marty Walsh, and James Wiley, who is also an East Boston resident.
Right.
So four men on the ballot.
I think when I looked at Mr. Cappucci's his campaign fund, not a lot of money in there.
Yeah.
And neither for Joseph Wiley. If you're running an issue campaign or if you're running to win, you need resources to get your message out there. Having 4 people in the race can either be, you know, if they have resources, if they have, organized constituencies behind them that are pushing for certain issues, then it can make a difference in sort of drive the discourse in the mayoral race. If they lack that, which it appears they do, then it makes them just 2 more names on the
ballot.
Less
of a factor. Could possibly factor into, when we get towards debate season or, candidate appearances, they'll clearly have more of a chance to get some earned media and to get some attention about, why are they running. One person who did not make the ballot is notable, Mary Franklin, who was the first person to announce her intention to run for office for the mayor's seat almost 2 years ago.
Right.
She's been, you know, very quietly campaigning, but is outspoken, especially on issues of violence and survivor issues, because she lost her husband to murder a couple of decades ago now. But Mary quite publicly this week complained about her lack of, her failure to make the ballot, and really cited it as being an unfair system, the way that candidates are certified to make the ballot. In Boston, you have to collect at least, or, you know, show at least 3,000 valid signatures of people who are registered voters in the city. It ends up actually being about 3,600 that are counted, because they get 3,000 and then add a cushion of 20% of 3,000, so 3,600 votes. Mary's complaint, really, which she aired on New England Cable News this week in an interview, was that candidates, the other candidates who were collecting signatures collected way more than they needed. Like Marty Walsh collected 35,000, Tito Jackson collected well over 10,000, and inferred then that that took signatures away from her. She claimed that only you can only sign for one candidate, which is kind of true. What's wrong about that is that you can sign as many forms as you want, right, as a voter, and nominate as many people for mayor as you want. But when it's actually counted by the election department, it'll be taken. Your name will count for one of them, and then be taken out of the pool for anyone else. But you know, there's four people who made the ballot. That ends up being about 14,500 votes out of the pool of a city with well over 300,000 registered voters. So her complaint sounds a little bit like sour grapes to me.
I think you really want a system where I mean, you know, where there's a bar to being in the race. I mean, if somebody's going to run an issues campaign, you still want to see them bring resources so they can get the issue on the table. If they're running to win, then they're going to need, you know, one person alone can't raise 3,000 signatures, but you also, one person alone can't get elected.
And they can't manage a city alone either. And it's an indicator. These are artificial barriers, really, to the ballot, so that ultimately there won't be just a sea of candidates. But it is a way to screen out folks who just aren't viable.
Right. You need social capital, and you need campaign contributions, quite frankly. And if you lack those things, you can't even run for district council in this city.
And you only need a couple of hundred signatures for district council. So folks who are thinking about running as an issues candidate might want to start there. That's another factor here. But in any event, it's going to be four-person ballot, all men, for mayor. But taking a quick look at the at-large race, that's not going to have a preliminary election because there are only eight people who did make the ballot, and they include the four incumbents and then a few other names that are familiar. Althea Garrison, of course, is on the ballot. William King of Dorchester, who's new. Pat Payaso of Roxbury. And Domingos DeRosa, who's an interesting candidate from Hyde Park. But that, because there's only eight of them, there won't be a preliminary in September, which is significant.
Right.
There will definitely be one in District 7.
I mean, 12 people on the ballot in District 7.
It's actually 13 now, 13. Because Carlos Enriquez, the former state rep, did make the ballot.
And they're all over the map as far as, you know, fundraising and volunteers go. Some of them seem like one-person operations, and then others, have teams of people. Deco Jabril in particular and Kim Janey both had campaign kickoffs with, well over 100 people and have raised significant amounts of money. Juan DePina's raised, at least 15 grand. I think Kim Janey's well over 30,000. But then you have candidates who are self-financing or candidates who've got nothing in their account. And you can really win a district council race with very little or no financial resources, but you have to have a team of volunteers. You have to have a tremendous amount of social capital to pull that off.
Right.
And you really have to have gotten your name out there before you get your name on the ballot. You have to have some record of accomplishment in your community. I think the field is large, but the field of viable candidates is a lot more slim.
Yeah. Well, watch for that, more coverage of that race. And the municipal election now is on. This ballot is pretty much set. So Much more coverage to come. Let's turn briefly. The reporter has several real estate related stories. Surprise, surprise. Development booming all over the place. One notable thing for folks in Dorchester and South Boston, 224 Boston Street, the very well regarded restaurant, is on the market. The building that it's in is on the market, but the restaurant is part of the deal. $2.5 million can buy you a great little neighborhood restaurant along with housing above. So that's a very big deal in the Polish Triangle section of Dorchester.
How many units is that there in 225? And it's a commercial unit, a restaurant, which should bring good income.
Yeah, and that comes with the license, which is fully transferable, 1 a.m. license. There's two residential apartments. Yeah. So I think the meat of the order here is the restaurant and a very, very well-regarded one at that.
Good location. Not a lot of parking in the area, but the restaurant has done fairly well.
It has done very well. It's a very popular spot, and it's a neighborhood place. A lot of people walk there, and that's a part of the city that's really changing right now because South Bay is expanding. There's a movie theater going in. I think the timing of this has a lot to do with that. There's a lot of new residential going up around there too.
Yeah.
So it's a hot neighborhood right now.
It's interesting because it doesn't have anywhere near the curb appeal of other parts of Dorchester, like Meeting House Hill or the Carruth Street, Ashmont Hill. It doesn't have large houses. It has lots of triple deckers that are packed closely together with very little in the way of a front yard, not a lot of trees.
Yeah.
I mean, 30, 20 years ago, it was a working class neighborhood.
Yeah.
And now you're seeing, buildings go for like a triple decker for more than $1 million, and here two residential units and a commercial unit for $2.5 million.
Yeah, it's an indicator of the very volatile market there, but that's the part of Dorchester that is most like South Boston in terms of its density and the way the streets and the housing are laid out
and public access, public transit access.
Yeah,
you're fairly close to the two
exactly,
stations.
You're close. Another big deal story on the cover of the reporter this week is a pretty significant development planned for Port Norfolk, which is the waterfront peninsula right around in Neponset Circle, where there's a marina there now, and there's another popular restaurant, Venezia. Boston Harbor Distillery has its headquarters there now. But a new buyer has come in and bought up the marina area.
You got to say where that is, because a lot of people have never set foot in that neighborhood.
So Port Norfolk is really cut off from much of the rest of the neighborhood by the expressway and Morrissey Boulevard. Neponset Circle, as you go by through Neponset Circle, Port Norfolk is off to your right.
Right. So if you're on Gallivan Boulevard, you go under the expressway and you're about to go over the bridge into Quincy and you want to get to Port Norfolk, you have to make a quick left and a quick right.
Yeah. It does take, a little bit of doing. And with GPS, it's been made easier. But
if you don't know where it is, you're not going to find it.
Probably not. And that's a part of the story, Yahoo, because the neighborhood that is there is heavily residential.
Right.
And they're already dealing with a lot of cut-through traffic that to go to the Venezia complex and the Boston Winery that's there. And, generally that's been fine. But now they want to add this new proposal, which would go on a 7.6-acre parcel right on the waterfront, would add 150 units of housing, a 25-room hotel, a refurbished marina, which would go where what is now called the Marine Max and Russo Marina site. So it would have... be a very popular probably destination for folks who have a boat to live there as well, and that's the kind of the idea is for it to be kind of an upscale marina slash housing, kind of like Marina Bay is in a way across the way in Quincy, but in Port Norfolk, which is not very accessible, as you mentioned, and there's a bridge that gets you in there from Neponset Circle, and there's also you come along the beachway from the other direction from Morrissey along Tinian Beach to get in there. But it's not a very smooth or accessible area.
And, there's a lot of, you have to get through traffic to get in and out of it. It's like a mini version of the South Boston Peninsula where there's, not a lot of ways in and out. And to get in and out, you have to get through some crazy traffic at different times of the day.
Yes, so City Point Capital has held a meeting on Saturday to show neighbors their plans, which, by the way, importantly, have already been filed with the city, with BPDA, for review.
Right.
And the neighbors, quite understandably, are like, well, maybe you should have come to us first.
Yeah.
So they had a meeting on Saturday, as expected, and we had a reporter in the room, Jen Smith, there were a lot of questions about, hey, how is this going to work? How are you going to accommodate new parking? They do plan to have a parking garage on the site. But the bigger issue is just getting in and out of there, and it's not always going to be by boat. So more cars in an area where there's a lot of strain already on that village, which is not necessarily welcome. So we're going to see. This is going to be an interesting one to watch because the build, baby, build nature of Boston does have some exceptions, and this could end up being one of them depending on how this neighborhood responds politically to this proposal.
Right. I mean, this is playing out all across Boston in you know, every neighborhood where you have like a large residential population. People are saying, okay, you know, we understand you need the density that you need to, you know, create housing for all the new people who are moving into Boston. But at what point do we say enough is enough, that we don't have the capacity for the traffic?
One final note on housing is in Cobman Square, a very interesting development. Washington Street, which is a new housing and mixed-use building that's going up at the corner of Dunbar Ave, which is close to the Dorchester High Complex, Unity Sports Club. Folks will know that very well. This is a kind of an interesting development with a three-story building going up. This was a former gas station that's been empty for a while. The city had control of the land. They put it out to bid. Development team won. Kind of a suburban development team that's coming in for the first time into this neighborhood, at least. And these are going to be kind of luxury units, although in talking to the development team this week in a story that we did, they assured us, or tried to, that they intend to market this to working families, as they described it. They're three-bedroom units, and I think they're going to come in around $500,000 per unit. These are going to be condos and not apartments. It'll also have a 850-square-foot retail space on floor one.
These will be well-compensated working families.
Yeah, exactly. These will be two adult household with deep pockets. But in talking to Tom Pyatt, who's one of the co-owners, he and his wife are developing this themselves. He's the architect. You know, he's like, listen, he understands the dynamic of the change that's coming along Washington Street. He says he wants to be, fairly selective and welcoming to the existing residents around there. We'll see. It's a nice looking building. A lot of the amenities are called net zero in terms of energy. There's going to be a solar array on the roof, bike friendly. It's a real interesting indicator of what the changes that are happening going that direction towards Cobman Square.
Yeah, all these developers are building these dense housing projects without the one parking space for every unit. They're putting in like bike parking in the basement, right?
Yeah, exactly. Well, this is going to be in the backyard apparently, but so keep an eye on that. And then finally, the Bay State Banner has a story about an interesting clock that's just been restored. A beautiful photo spread on page 3 of the Banner showing the inner workings of this clock, which is located in the First Church of Roxbury.
Right. So the First Church of Roxbury has been a church on that site since the Puritans arrived in Roxbury in 1630. The first church that the Puritans built was in 1632. There was a church that burned, or was actually no, it was damaged during the Revolutionary War.
Wow.
By cannon fire from the British, because it was being used as a signal tower during the siege of Boston. And Roxbury was, that part of Roxbury was strategic. George mm-hmm. Washington's army had a command post up there, and then again they were using the steeple as a signal tower. So it was damaged by cannonballs, and they raised it and built this new church in 1804. That building is intact. The first clock that went in was taken out of service in 1863 or so. Now, we know that the new clock began operation in August 26th of 1863, because there's a ton of graffiti in that bell tower if you go in there from, decades and centuries.
Wow.
And so, the people from E. Howard and Company Clocks, it was a Roxbury-based firm. They were down in Dudley Square. when they installed this clock, they wrote that in pencil, like, you know, this clock commenced operation, you know, August 26, 1863.
That's some polite graffiti right there.
Yeah, I mean, most of the graffiti, you know, it's inside a church. It's polite, so this is a four-faced clock. When it was commissioned in 1863, when it went most people in Boston didn't have clocks in their homes, didn't have watches. Mm. I mean, this was one, it would be one of the ways that you would be able to tell time in Roxbury. There's a bell from the Paul Revere Foundry that's, you know, located right above the clock. That tolls on the hour now. So just really restoring, you know, this colonial era church from the early years of the American Republic. You know, it's been, you know, it's a $3 million renovation project.
That's big.
They're beginning to do the inside of the building. They repainted it last year in a historically correct off-white color. It would have been, you know, like if they painted something white in 1804, it wouldn't have been the kind of flat white that we have now. So, you know, it's just really, they've done a really great job here.
Make sure you check it out yourself and go see how the clock's operating. It's in John Elliott Square, right near Dudley. One last thing, the Dorchester House Tour is this weekend on Sunday from roughly 11:30 to 4, and that's happening in the Ashmont Carruth Street neighborhood this year. It is a fundraiser for the Dorchester Historical Society, so there's a ticket of $30 or $35 if you buy it at the site, which is you go to the All Saint Church near Peabody Square next to Ashmont Station to start the tour. 10 historic homes on the route and a beautiful way to kind of connect into that community. Looks like the weather's going to be very nice on Sunday, so that's good news. This is another opportunity to see history right up front. Your story this week is a great illustration of the amazing history in Roxbury and Dorchester in these neighborhoods that were once towns of their own and became now, you know, busy city neighborhoods. But everywhere you turn, there's another hidden jewel like the clock in the First Church of Roxbury. The First Parish Church of Dorchester is another good example. And this neighborhood tucked in next to Ashmont Station.
Right. Roxbury and Dorchester both have history going back to the, you know, early days of the Massachusetts Bay Colony. So, you know, homes that are built in the colonial and federal style. And in the Dorchester, in this tour, it's one of the first big building booms in Boston was in this Victorian era when Dorchester was transforming from a farming community into a streetcar suburb. And so you're seeing houses that were built in the grand style of Victorian architecture, and it's going to be a treat.
Well, hope to see you out there this weekend. This has been Front Page Boston on 102.9 WBCA. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Bill Forey of The Reporter.
I'm Yahoo Miller from the Bay State Banner.
See you next time.